You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. 8:30 and live in the studios with us once again, despite knowing better, it's Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State.
You know, I really enjoy how the station's air conditioning helps bring a little bit of winter into our summer mornings.
Yes, your goosebumps are very prominent.
Yeah, I know that. No, that's my nose.
Oh. It's hard to see behind that enormous microphone there. Well, we do that, you know, to keep you awake, because I don't want you falling asleep at this hour of the day. It's easy to do.
I hear that just before you die, you feel kind of warm and cuddly. You know, it's just that, like, warm feeling just as you nod off to your last final sleep.
Unless you freeze to death.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah, the 10 signs of hypothermia.
Uh-huh.
All right.
So
Counterspin was covering stuff on the FISA rulings. Is that how you say it, FISA? FISA?
Yes. Well, I mean, nobody was ever saying it before last week because we had no idea it existed. But speaking of being left in the cold, the Bush administration has really had a very, very bad run the last couple of months with courts, and sometimes they're court appointees from the Clinton administration, and sometimes they're Bush senior and Reagan appointees. But they've had a very bad run with courts saying that their policies, well, particularly after 9/11, although the FISA ruling actually covered areas of prosecutorial abuse during Clinton and Bush administrations over the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. But Ashcroft's post 9/11 policies, the Bush administration's post 9/11 policies, have really come in for kind of a butt kicking. The most recent of that happened on Monday in Cincinnati with the Third District Court. It's a ruling out of Michigan where a gentleman there was several Detroit newspapers and a local congressperson sued over a memo that came out on September 26th of last year from Michael Crepy, who is the INS head lawyer, at the direction of a memo from John Ashcroft, basically closing all of the court rulings or court hearings, I'm sorry, over INS issues that have national security implications. Of course, the INS and the DOJ determined which cases would have national security implications and what the criteria were. Those were never made public. But a remarkable number of hearings, over 600, were actually held in secret. This was a case that was specific to the Third District. It only covers three states. And there will be another appeal of a lower court ruling that will be heard in Philadelphia in a couple of weeks that will be broader. That will cover the entire country. But once again, the language was very, very strong, saying that the Bush administration, essentially the direct quote was, "Democracy dies behind closed doors." Mm-hmm. That's the one that made it into all the news accounts. But there was that. There's been the FISA ruling. There was an earlier ruling regarding the release of the names of the detainees. One of these issues, actually, here in Seattle, we have a gentleman who's been in jail for a year who is on the list. There are only, however, for the people who had the closed hearings, there was a letter, the most recent estimate of from the Department of Justice of how many people were being held under those conditions was down from the original 1,200. It was they said 700 rather than 1,200 this past spring. And then a couple of months ago, in a letter to Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan, the Department of Justice said there were only 81 left, and the local person is one of those. Mm-hmm. But even though that number is probably vastly undercounted, because there are a number of people who have been shuffled off into other types of deportation hearings depending on their different immigration statuses, and it's very difficult to count because there's no systematic way of counting. It's basically self-identified. If somebody has been in jail for the last year and they haven't been able to contact a lawyer, or they haven't contacted a lawyer and people don't know they're there, we have no way of counting them. But even so, the fact that 90% of the people are gone you know, from that original list from a year ago, from the 700 down to the 80, I mean, even under the best of circumstances, that suggests that these court rulings that are being held, by the time they get up to the Supreme Court, it's going to be another year before the Supreme Court rules on all of these. And the government has appealed every one of these rulings that they've lost. Yeah. Well, no, they almost certainly will if the Philadelphia hearing this month goes the other way. There are two criteria. Are that it's a case of national importance, and if there's been any kind of division in how lower courts have ruled, particularly the former in this case, there hasn't been that much division, actually.
I know. I'm expecting the lower courts to be pretty united in saying that the DOJ's been
But what happens is that the Supreme Court will place weight on it because the government's rhetoric has been so strong. This is a national security issue. We're giving terrorists the upper hand. I mean, they're very heavy-handed in their rhetoric. But, you know, by the time these rulings take effect, most of the people who were detained after 9/11 are going to have been deported, or, you know, we won't know what will have happened to them. In many cases, they're going back to South Asia or North Africa or the Middle East to despotic regimes, being labeled the object of anti-terror investigations by the United States. So their futures in those countries are pretty grim because, you know, their home governments aren't likely to look with much favor upon these folks. So they really are rulings that may set a precedent for the future, but it really shows the limit of the checks and balances because you have these tremendous abuses that have already been taking place for a year. There's really, you know, there have been stays of some of these rulings because of the Justice Department's claims of national security, pending the higher court appeals. And so, you know, by the time it all gets sorted out in the courts, you've had anywhere between 1 and 2 years of a window where these abuses can take place where there's no accountability. And in that period of time, you know, people are being shipped to places from which they may never come out of a basement dungeon again. It's very, very frightening stuff.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then closer to home, there's a case that's somewhat tied into that of James Ujamaa.
Yeah, you can look at the indictment of James Ujamaa and five men in Detroit as a bit of Bush administration response to some of these reversals in the lower courts. James Ujamaa was indicted this week. The indictment is very, very vague. He's charged with having provided training, facilities, computer services, safe houses, and personnel to Al-Qaeda, which is not at all clear. But here's the kicker. The indictment reads, knowing that they would be used to, quote, murder and maim persons located outside the United States, end quote. Now think about that. To murder and maim persons located outside the United States. You know, I mean, he's not charged with a terrorist act. He's not charged with trying to murder and maim American citizens.
Isn't that what
our
military does?
I know. I know. I mean, think about how vague that is.
You know, if he just signed up for that college tuition and job training out of high school, he would have been considered an American hero by now for doing the same thing.
That's right. If he'd gone through boot camp.
Yeah.
Instead, he wanted to set up his own little boot camp called the Ultimate Jihad Challenge, which sounds a little bit more like a vacation retreat for Islamic fundamentalists than it really does a terrorist training camp in Oregon. The important point is that he was not charged with committing a terrorist act. The Bush administration, the FBI, can't really get their act together in deciding that this guy is really a terrorist. They know that kind of a charge would not stick. So they're charging him with some very, very, very vague things. What we do know about James Ujamaa, we know he's a website designer, although he didn't design the website that they say he did. Another person has come forward and said that he designed that website for the fundamentalist person in Britain that the FBI is really trying to target.
Yeah, and since when is designing a website a federal crime?
I know. James Ujamaa has his own website that has a lot of very radical political stuff on it, but nothing that advocates violence, which is also something that's been frustrating to the FBI. What we also know about James Ujamaa is that he was a businessman and he was an activist. He helped minority kids get off drugs. He published entrepreneurial books like The Young People's Guide to Starting a Business. He was recognized by the Washington State Legislature with a special certificate of special congressional recognition for his work with kids and drug rehabilitation. He attempted to have a self-published novel turned into a movie in Hollywood, and when that didn't work, he moved to London. And in London, he converted to radical Islam, and he met Abu Hamza, the man that the FBI is trying to get their hands on. Abu Hamza, they say, was the head of a Yemeni terrorist group that was responsible for the bombing of the USS Cole. It's kind of hard to figure that out, though, since the USS Cole was bombed when Abu Hamza was not in Yemen, so it's kind of hard to really understand where they think he is the leader. He certainly is a spiritual leader for radical Muslims. He's the head of a mosque in Britain. However, the British government has not put him under arrest, has not charged him with anything, and my feeling is that they don't believe he is really guilty of anything. What's interesting about all this is, as this is going on, I read in the Seattle Times, in the Sunday paper, there was a little five-paragraph article on page A9. I'm going to read you a little excerpt from
this
article.
And this being the Seattle Times, which has tried their best to convict James Ujamaa.
Absolutely. I'm just going to read you a little excerpt from it. It's called, "Plot Suspect Had Arsenal, Police Say. A doctor suspected of hatching an elaborate plot to blow up dozens of mosques and an Islamic education center had enough expertise and firepower to carry it out," police said yesterday. Robert Goldstein possessed an arsenal powerful enough to level the 200-unit townhouse complex where he lives and a detailed mission template full of instructions, officials said. So what do they say about this guy? Do they say he's a terrorist? No. Do they say that he's a risk, that he's trying to murder and maim American citizens? No. This is what they say about him. They say, quote, "He was just a smart guy," end quote. And a little further on in the article, they say, quote, "It was like a James Bond thing," end quote.
well, as opposed to the summer survival cap from Muslim fundamentalists.
Yeah, I mean, now that does not sound... Having the weapons, the expertise, the plan laid out in black and white to bomb mosques and kill people does not sound like a James Bond thing to me. It sounds like a terrorist thing to me. Now, the James Ujamaa thing sounds like a James Bond thing to me, setting up the ultimate jihad challenge,
right,
riding around in jeeps on a farm in Oregon and shooting stuffed deers with AK-47. That sounds like a James Bond thing, you know? So I think it's kind of interesting how these things are reported and what the slant is.
So maybe we need to cut that article out of the paper and fax it to the Justice Department.
Yeah, actually, it's worked the other way around with a lot of the Ujamaa stuff, and I've mentioned this on this program before. It's more been like the Justice Department has been, you know, cutting out little articles and faxing them to the Times and saying, "Here, slap your byline on this." You know, it really has been very striking. We've seen it now with the PI too. Since the since the indictment came down, the PI's reporting has become much less skeptical on this story, and it needs to be.
This week, the PI has kind of followed the Seattle Times' lead and is doing their best to really show James Ujamaa as a terrorist or someone who's very dangerous, which is disturbing because in the past the PI was the one that was doing some investigative journalism and bringing to light some of the things that would throw some doubt on the FBI's indictment. So
yeah, and you know, aside from ideological bias, it really plays once again into this tremendous cheerleading civic thing that goes on with our newspapers. It's always got to be Seattle is really important. I mean, we really have a homegrown terrorist now. Isn't this more evidence that we're a world-class city? And, you know, it's just not true. Or it certainly doesn't appear like it's true. You know, what we need is a media that is willing to be skeptical of what the government says in these cases, because we have not yet seen one indictment out of all of these remarkable expansions of investigative capacity and the detainees and the detentions and all the rest of that. You know, nobody in this country has been charged with as a result of these investigations with planning terrorist acts in the last year. The couple three people who have been arrested have been Reed, who came on an airplane from over the Atlantic. That was the guy with the shoe, and Jose Padilla, who hasn't even been charged
and who had no weapons on him
and no plans at all. Yeah, so so you know, you have to wonder. It's like, you know, we've given these remarkable expansions of powers. We're coming up on the first year anniversary, and we'll get all of these retrospectives. How about looking at what hasn't happened in the last year? One of the things that hasn't happened is that despite this enormous expansion of state power, there's been nothing to show for it in terms of preventing terrorism. Now, there have been plenty of other things to show for it in terms of ruined lives, but...
Mm-hmm. Or new bustling industries.
Yeah, that's true, too.
So, all right. Well, again, closer to home, there is a another proceeding, an inquest around the Robert Thomas Sr. shooting that's been started this week, I believe, and is going to continue into
the first part of next week.
Yep. Do you want to start in on this? We haven't checked in. We may want to be saying the same things on this. But
I actually have been following it quite closely.
Of course, I get
the PI and I get the Seattle Post Intelligencer and Jav gets the Seattle Times. So we both get a little bit of a different view on it through the different local newspapers.
Well, I've also been talking to somebody who's been at the hearings every day.
Yeah,
so,
and yeah. That's good. That's very good. I've been moving this week, so I've been just barely getting my news from a suspect source. but even the news that I get from the suspect source has me questioning some of the stuff that's coming out in the inquest. For example, when you read that the neighbor who called Mel Miller, the off-duty King County police officer, to go down and warn the Thomases, who were sitting in their pickup truck partially blocking a private road, to warn them to move, he told Mel Miller, he said, there were two black men in the front of the pickup. And then he also told the jury that he felt like they made him uncomfortable. And that's why he didn't warn them away himself, which is evidence of racism. You know, if there were two white kids or two white men in the front of a pickup truck, he wouldn't have felt that, you know, kind of uncomfortable.
The call probably never would have been made in the first place.
Right, and he wouldn't have certainly told him there are two white guys sitting in a truck. He would have said two guys sitting in a truck. Another thing that was interesting is when Mel Miller was testifying, he said that he went down to talk to them because he thought they might be stranded or need some help or need someone to call 911 for them. However, when he left his home to walk down to talk to them, he did not take his cell phone with him, as you would expect. He took his Glock semi-automatic gun with him.
Yeah, which he stuck in his waistband and went down to offer his helping neighborly hand. I mean, and when he went down there, I mean, I'm sorry, not...
Oh, no, that's
should I leap in or not? I don't know.
Oh, no, there's just a couple of other things.
Go right ahead, because I may be leaping in with what you have.
Let's see. Mel Miller says that he remembered only shooting his gun twice, yet there were three shots fired, which is not unusual. Sometimes people's memories change or they don't remember things exactly in a time of stress.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it's also a semi-automatic gun.
Right. Nevertheless, Miller said that he saw very clearly that Thomas Sr. was holding a gun in his hand. However, after he fired the shots, he said that the truck had darkly tinted windows, and so he had to move in order to get a good view inside the cab. Those two things are very contradictory statements to me. It would suggest that he didn't see the gun per se. He saw him lift his hand, and he shot him anyway.
Yeah, dark hand, looks kind of like a gun.
And then the final straw was reading that Mel Miller himself said that he didn't identify himself as a King County deputy until after he fired the gunshots, which in my mind says that Thomas Sr. had every reason to pull out a gun on this guy who comes and challenges him and has a gun in his hand. It's not clear. Mel Miller says that he didn't have the gun in his hand first, that Robert Thomas Sr. drew first, but both of the witnesses inside the pickup truck said that it was the off-duty sheriff's deputy who had his gun out first.
Yeah, and even more remarkable than that, perhaps, although I think that's really very telling that he did not identify himself.
And he admits it.
He also admits that when he went down to to confront or offer a helping hand, depending upon whom you believe, the Thomases and the third passenger in the truck. He was not going down there as a police officer. He was going down there as a private citizen. Well, then why not try him as a private citizen? If it were a private citizen that were going down there, number one, Thomas would have every right to pull a gun on this angry guy who's you know, coming out there and clearly threatening bodily harm. I mean, you know, Thomas or Miller himself has said that, you know, that it became a confrontational very quickly. You know, that's not illegal. But beyond that, Miller is being treated with the deference accorded a police officer, even though he did not act as a police officer, even though he did not act as a sheriff's deputy. He claims
that as his defense, that he was acting as a civilian.
And that shouldn't be the defense. That should be the reason to bring criminal charges against this man. The fact that he shot to kill, the fact that he had he certainly knew how to use his weapon because he had plenty of ongoing training at taxpayer expense. I mean, there are ways in which clearly the fact that he was a police officer influenced what he did and how he did it. But in terms of how he was operating on that day and how he approached the Thomases, he says himself as his defense, that he was operating as a private citizen. And yet you have everyone from the lowest recruit to the highest ranking law enforcement officer in King County automatically defending this guy because of what he does during his job hours. And people in the public automatically granting his testimony, and of course, because of what he does for a living, he's also much more comfortable and experienced in court, automatically granting his testimony much more weight and much more credibility than the eyewitnesses, including, you know, relatives of the victim. In a normal court proceeding, it would be exactly the opposite. You would give the shooter's testimony the most skepticism. And that simply is not happening here, and it should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I think the worst thing about the whole thing is that during the inquest hearing, you had Mel Miller saying that after he fired the shots, he moved to the back of the truck, trained his gun on the truck, and did nothing while Robert Thomas Sr. died. The son claims that he was calling for help all throughout that time. Whether or not he was calling for help, there was someone shot in the truck. You know, maybe they had a gun in their hand, maybe they didn't, but he was allowed to die. It took 10 minutes at least for police to arrive and longer for the medics to arrive.
And not just allowed to die, but the other two people who were in the truck were clearly terrified out of their mind. It's not like they're going to go, you know, running to a neighbor for help.
They're not going to get out.
They're not going to get out of the truck.
I wouldn't get out of the truck in that situation.
No, I wouldn't either, because I'd be afraid that I'd be the next one dead. I mean, you know, so basically what Miller is saying is that he went as a private citizen and he executed the guy. He shot to kill, number one, and then he impeded medical help from arriving, which may or may not have been able to save him. That's not clear. But I mean, it's just an appalling tableau of events, and yet this guy's, you know, being treated deferentially because of what he does during his work hours.
So the inquest continues this week.
The inquest continues this week. We have not had in 30 years of this particular inquest system in King County a law enforcement officer found culpable
in a shooting
or in a death that involves a civilian, and that includes something like 150 cases. So, you know, it's 150-0 right now. So even when the evidence is overwhelming, which it is not in this case, it's basically a he said, they said kind of thing in this case. And, you know, we'll see how much credibility the jury gives to the shooter's testimony.
All right. Well, moving along. You really couldn't miss either of them, both the baseball and Boeing strike this week, as well as even smaller strikes, several teacher strikes, lots of coverage of strikes, yet not a lot of of information.
One of the interesting things that I think about the teachers' strikes, I hadn't thought about this earlier in the week, but reading about it later this week, I was thinking, you know, essentially the Boeing workers are striking for much of the same things the teachers are striking for, essentially health care and maintaining adequate health care benefits from their employers instead of having to pay $300, $400, $500 a month in order to cover your family for their health insurance, you know, and nobody really realizes until they're faced with that situation how much that cuts into your income and your monthly budget.
And, you know, this is something actually that small business owners have been having to wrestle with for the last several years, too. The cost of health care in this country is it's a burden on everyone. It's a burden on employers. It's a burden on employees. And, I mean, there's no logical reason that health care should even be associated with what you do for a living. It's an incredible drain on our economy, and people don't associate the impact that it has on seemingly unrelated things like labor relations.
Mm-hmm. One of the other interesting things about the Boeing strike is I've noticed it's been reported side by side with the baseball strike this week in most newspapers. However, they never really look at the similarities and differences of the two. In my mind, the similarity is that in the baseball strike, you have debt pressure on the owners of teams that don't do very well. For example, the Mariners.
The Mariners do very, very well, actually.
Yeah. But I mean, they also have a high debt from new stadium construction, and in order to pay that debt, they need to lower player salaries. It's very similar to what Boeing and other major corporations are going through, debt from acquisitions. They've bought other companies, so they have to lower their salary costs. The one place they think they can save some money is in salary and benefits.
Yeah, although the Mariners really can't go play 30 games a year in China or Indonesia. So
yeah, that's true. That's one of the differences, you know, and that's something that the media can't discuss. The difference being, and won't discuss, the differences being that you can't ship the Mariners' jobs overseas. Another difference is that baseball players make millions while the Boeing employees make just a livable wage. Now, we don't often look at that. You hear people who are against a Boeing strike saying, oh, those guys make a lot of money, they have great benefits, blah, 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 blah. But wait a second. The federal poverty level for a family of four is $18,000 a year. Twice that amount is still considered an inadequate salary, $36,000 a year. Boeing machinists make about $54,000 a year, which is enough, just barely. I mean, we don't really look at...
Particularly in a place like Seattle with very high housing costs.
Exactly, with a high cost of living. We don't really look at that, the federal poverty level and twice the federal poverty level being an average over the whole nation, including places where it's much cheaper to live. Here it's very expensive to live, and $54,000 doesn't necessarily support you and a spouse and a child or two children anymore. So the Boeing machinists, they're not even asking for a wage increase. They're asking for pension benefits increases, and they want to just hold the line on job security, and they want to hold the line on their health insurance costs. They're just trying to keep the company from taking those away.
Yeah, and the pension is certainly important too, because we've seen any number of these debt laden companies go in and try and raid the pension funds in one way or another. But you know, the big issue really is the outsourcing and the fact that the machinists are we've heard this all throughout the local media coverage, that there are just a lot fewer of them than there were even 5 years ago. But what we haven't heard is that this has been a very intentional policy, not just of Boeing, but of the Clinton and Bush administration.
And it's not just been with this recession. It's been going on all along.
Yes, it has. That our taxpayer money is being used to finance particularly on the weapons side, but also on the commercial aviation side, finance the marketing costs, the credit costs for shipping some of these planes overseas. And when they do, part of the deal also is that you manufacture part of the plane overseas in the country that's buying as well. That's part of what the countries that are buying want as part of the deal. It's called an offset. And so what you have is tax money being used by the Clinton administration and now by the Bush administration very aggressively in order to finance shipping good jobs from the Puget Sound to places like China or Turkey or Indonesia.
Real quickly, only if you can do it in a minute, there was an important WTO ruling that came down just the end of this week.
Yeah, that $4 billion is what the United States will owe each year if it does not change the legislation which underwrites the corporate tax benefits that accrue to companies like Boeing and Microsoft for their export efforts, for the merchandise that they sell overseas.
It's essentially a bill that saves them from having to pay taxes on income that they make make abroad.
Yeah. And it's a direct subsidy for companies like Boeing. And we've seen this with any number of industries. That's the first one to come down the pike. The farm bill, the steel bill. There are any number of areas in which the United States rhetoric is free trade, but in which in practice is very protectionist.
Those cases are going to come up before the WTO in the future, and they're going to be deciding on those issues. And of course, it's going to be an easy decision because you can't in any way, shape, or form say that those things promote free trade or level the playing field all over the world.
And then the issue at that point becomes, does the United States respect international law or does it flout it once again?
Does it ignore the WTO ruling and go its own way?
Yeah, because the United States at that point has the ability to have Congress pass new legislation every year or every 2 years. The WTO has to go through and litigate it and find that it violates the laws all over again, and then the cycle just repeats indefinitely.
All right. Well, so it sounds like we'll be coming back to this over
probably
and over and over. With that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell us, what is Eat the State?
It is a community volunteer newspaper. Comes out every other week with lots of boffo information, local and global and every place in between. And we also like to make fun of things. Yes, boffo. It's a fine word. You can find it free at bookstores and cafes, places where you find free publication. You can also find it on the web, www.eatthestate.org. And if you would like to volunteer, if you would like to offer story ideas, write the stories yourselves, help out with the distribution, fundraising, donations are always wonderful, or just feedback on stories, story tips, give us a call. Our voicemail, area code 206-903-9461.